Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Happy New Year, everybody. Hope 2024 is treating you nice so far. Have you ever wondered how your wine actually makes it to the shelf of a retailer? Well, on today's podcast, we're going to talk about that complex journey with Travis Todd of Delibu Wines in the Willamette Valley. We're going to talk about his journey from wine buyer at a prestigious Montana club to becoming a winemaker and farmer. We're also going to dive into the three-tier system and how hard that is to navigate for a small winery. Before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. Did you know on SOMTV right now, on all apps, on any device, you can watch a roundup of some of the greatest winemakers from Napa discuss the 2023 vintage, which is shaping up to be one of the greatest vintages in the history of Napa, which is astounding. This really long, long growing season. They picked late. I mean, they were picking, in some cases, into early November. It was crazy. And so what it did is it allowed the wine to age and age and age on the vine and really gave this incredible structured wine. So we sat down up in Napa with a bunch of winemakers and they went through it. And you can watch that for free right now on SOMTV on any device, on our app or on the web. So go to SOMTV.com or download the apps and you can watch that for free right now. Without further ado, our conversation about the three-tier system and navigating it as a small winery.
Hi, everyone. I'm Claire Copey, and on this week's episode, I'm joined by another fantastic winemaker, and I'm excited to chat with him about a side of winemaking that we haven't really covered up until this point. We talk a lot about the work that happens in the vineyards, in the winery, all the decisions that lead to that wine being bottled, but then we haven't really discussed what happens once that wine's been bottled, how it gets onto the wine list at your restaurant, onto the shelves at the local wine store, the grocery store, and especially how that works for a small producer. So talking to Travis Todd here, he is the founder and winemaker of Delibu Wines in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Travis, how are you doing?
I'm great, Claire. Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for coming to get nerdy with us about wine sales.
I think it's a fun topic because it is, we can talk our eyes out about what we do in the vineyard. And, you know, when you start a winery, you don't know how you're going to get it out there. You're just like, I made some wine. And then there's all these other things that you do. And, you know, you spend 3% of your time making wine, maybe more than that. But there's just so many other hoops to jump through and kind of the business pieces that need to make sense.
I mean, there's such a romance about, you know, the winemaking and the vineyard and all that. And we love all those aspects. We love nerding out on the soils and all the techniques in the winery. But yeah, I don't think a lot of people think the massive amount of work it takes, especially as a small producer, to get the wines out there. Because you can make the most amazing wine in the world, right? But what does it matter if it's not in our glasses and we're enjoying it?
I agree 100%.
So tell us a little bit about your journey to Delibu and your journey in the wine world, because you've worked at some really, really cool places.
Thank you. I thought they were cool too when I worked there. It's been a neat journey. I mean, I think, you know, coming through college, I'd always worked in restaurants and bars, didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. So I kept working in restaurants and bars, ended up moving out to Montana to ski and work in restaurants and bars. And I ended up finding myself with a job at a place called the Yellowstone Club. And so for people that don't know what that is, it's a private ski resort for very wealthy people who can ski in a private ski mountain. It's pretty wild. It's kind of a crazy place. In the evening, you know, I'd ski all day. And then in the evening, I would go and, you know, wait tables or work in the bar. And I started seeing, you know, there's this massive wine list. And I didn't know that much about wine. I knew that there were certain wines in the world that were more renowned than others. But I'm looking through this book that's like everything. I mean, there's like no duds in the cellar. You know what I mean? Like anyone's like, pick me out something good. And you're like, okay, I could like blindly grab something. It was like not going to strike out ever, you know?
How big is that cellar? How many bottles are in that?
Man, it's probably bigger now because they've grown in a crazy way. But I mean, when I was there, it was like several million dollars worth of wine. All varying degrees of there's crazy expensive things and then things that are like pretty affordable and normal. Was a well curated wine list that wasn't just full of like Petrus and ridiculous things. You know, I mean, those things were certainly there because those are the folks that can buy those. But yeah, there were just everyday things in there as well. I mean, it was really like I would credit the people that curated the list before me in a great way to like that influenced my learning about wine and like diving down the rabbit hole. It was like, oh, why is this good? What's the context around it? You know, I think contextual wines are ones that you maybe weren't sure that you liked, but you're like, this is interesting to me. And then you build some context around it. You're like, oh, okay, I see why this is that way. And like, you know, I think that's really important. Anyway, I got exposed to all these different wines and kind of started training my palate a little bit of like what I like and what I think is cool. And then also building it on the membership and saying, hey, you know, this person likes this type of wine. So then, you know, I eventually got promoted to being the wine buyer there. And I've told this story before, but they're like, hey, you really seem to be interested in the wine and you're not stealing from us. So like, you want to be in charge of it, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. You know,
wow, that's a big...
Yeah, I totally do. So then I would, you know, I started learning from the membership what they liked. And then I would be able to taste things with a distributor or when I, you know, try to go on a trip or something and taste something, I would be thinking of those people's palates in mind as well as my own to try and say, oh, I know three people that are going to like this. You know, like I know that when they walk in, eventually you gain their trust. And I think this happens in lots of restaurants and wine shops. Mm. You gain their trust and someone comes in, they're like, Travis, I trust you. Just pick out, you know what I like, pick something cool for me. And I got to start doing things like that, you know, you know, there are a lot of people that were really wealthy and they're like, pick me out something I like. It's like, well, you'll have the most expensive thing. You know, like you don't always want to do that. I think it was way more fun to give them something that was like that they liked, you know, that was really cool and maybe make a pairing or a suggestion, like get the trust of someone and then make a suggestion or a pairing that was like, I don't think that's supposed to go together. And then
a little unexpected.
Know, just try it, dude.
Just blow their minds.
So anyway, I guess that's a roundabout way of telling you that that's where I kind of fell in love with wine and got to taste really unique things. And then I came out to Oregon in 2014. I went to Pinot Camp, which is an awesome, you know, it wasn't an introduction to Oregon, but it was just amazing to see how many other wines there were. Because we're in Montana, so it wasn't like every wine in the world is available to you. Most of the things would be special ordered that were at the Yellowstone Club if they weren't already readily available in the state. So I got to taste unbelievable things. And I would say that I fell in love with the culture of Oregon almost more than the wines. I mean, the wines are always stellar and there were ones that I really loved and, you know, Pinot Noir is what I love. So I got to kind of come see that. And then I worked at Harvest in 2014. And when I worked Harvest, I just wanted to keep learning more. And I finally, you know, I came out and I was like, I want to do this. I never had so much fun making so little money that I was like, I'm going to move back here someday. So anyway, I went back to Montana for a couple of years actually. And then was kind of phasing out of the restaurant side of the world. And I'd had a job offer to work for a distributor and it wasn't going to pay me very much money. And my now wife said, what would you do if you could do anything in the world? And I was like, I'd move back to Oregon and make wine. And she said, let's go. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to marry her, I guess.
Yeah. That's a winner right there.
Yeah. So anyway, we're now married, which is great. And she helps out a little bit with sales around here and she's done every job in the vineyard as well with me. So anyway, that's how we got to Oregon. And then after being here, worked for a really large winery. It was the fourth largest winery in Oregon by volume. So we made a lot of different brands, Rascal and Duck Pond and Ransom. It was a great learning experience. And that's, I kind of got a job, ran into my old cellar master and then got a job almost immediately because he remembered me and I worked hard. And then I moved up to become the winemaker over a number of years. And I'd started De La Boue on the side with a buddy of mine and I scraped together a couple thousand bucks and bought 2 tons of grapes. And because we wanted to make wines that we could focus on as opposed to, you know, large production schedule. I think those things are invaluable. And I think it's a place where I really was able to hone a lot of different skills because you see so many different, you know, tiers of fruit that are coming in. But I wasn't getting to focus on something like really focus on it. So we started to do this on the side, which is crazy to think of now. We asked if we could carve out a little spot in the winery and I could make a little bit of wine. And they said, sure. Good luck.
Oh,
good luck,
great.
Idiot.
They're like, oh no, not another one.
Look at them all bright eyed and bushy tailed. Anyway,
first vintage of Dillon?
That was in 2019.
Okay.
So I worked 2 years.
Was it just Pinot Noir or were you doing the Syrah as well?
Pinot Noir and Syrah, both those. Okay. Yeah, 2019. So we just did like 150 cases and, you know, lucky enough to sell all of them to, I say, friends and family that probably felt sorry for us. They're like, I guess I'll buy some. the best part about it was that the next year people were like buying more. And it was like, oh man, they actually liked it. This is really cool.
Doing something right.
So that's kind of how we did it. And now we're on our fifth harvest. We just wrapped up our fifth harvest, which is crazy. And I've gone full time on it.
That's amazing. Congrats.
This is where we
are. It's a big accomplishment. And you purchased some, you have your own vineyard site now, correct? You have your own.
Yeah. So we actually the first vineyard that we ever worked with, and we don't own the vineyard, but we farm the grapes there. So not coming at this with a tremendous amount of money on the front end. I should have done something that would have made me more successful. It would have been a little easier earlier on. But, you know, we just try to find really unique ways to make our business work. And so we farm the vineyard. It's 5 acres in the Chehalem Mountains, actually the Laurelwood District now. Yeah. And it's been, you know, that was something that came about during the pandemic. They asked if I wanted to help farm the vineyard, and we weren't allowed to do anything on the weekends. So I started farming this vineyard while I worked my full-time job. And, you know,
wow.
it made it, you know, made us able to attain kind of our goals as a business by making the cash flow work for us. It was like, it's my time and my money. I mean, it's my time and not much money. It made it work, and it got us closer to the dream of like doing this on our own for ourselves, because we want to have our own vineyard someday. So this is a great practice and a much less expensive way to figure out if we really want to do this or not.
Sure. You know, and you really want to do this.
totally. I mean, I think you have to really want to do it, because there's, I mean, Claire, you know this, there are so many better ways to make money. If you just want to make money, there are bunch of other places that you should go do that. This is something that you've really got to love and want to do.
Yeah.
And it helped 100%. It helped inform us on people that we wanted to work with and other vineyards that we work with. You know, who are the people? Are they kind of in the same mindset as us? So it's been a great, you know, kind of experience to be able to do that.
And so how many cases are you guys producing now?
So the 2023 vintage will be about 2,500 cases.
Wow. So you went from 150 to now 2,500.
Yes.
Which is crazy. So now you're at the point where you need to, you know, you've got a lot more wine and you need to get it out there. So what is that process like, especially as a smaller producer? Because these bigger producers have a much different path of getting these wines out there, which I'm sure you experienced some of at this large winery that you were the winemaker at. I guess first we should get into the three-tier system of selling wine. So what is the three-tier system? How can you explain that to us?
I can do my best. So the three-tier system is, you know, when alcohol was deregulated and coming out of prohibition, it was left up to the states to decide how they would like to deal with selling a regulated substance, i.e. alcohol. And so each state has its own laws, has its own version of what they think is the right way to do it. And there are articles abound bashing the three-tier system. I think there are pros and cons to everything. And I'll talk about some of both of those, I guess, here. But what you end up having is that you know, to sell to someone else that's going to sell your wine, you have to legally have a middleman in almost every state. So, you know, this is to protect the consumer so that people with licenses can have access to alcohol and not sell it to minors. So that, you know, all of this is created to protect the consumer, which is net a good thing. I think that we should not forget that there are real positives to the way that it's done. Now, there are also, I guess we can get into, I'll finish out the three-tier system and then we can get into
the
more specifics of it. But basically you have to have a distributor that can legally sell to a licensed retailer or restaurant. So I have to sell to a distributor in a state. Let's just pick one. For example, Massachusetts. We like our guys in Massachusetts. So I'll use them as an example. So to sell to a restaurant in Massachusetts, we have to sell to this distributor first, and then the distributor sells it to the restaurant or the retail shop. So that's kind of the overview of the system.
So producer, distributor, and then restaurant, retailer. Retail shop, yeah.
Yep. And it's kind of crazy because the way that things have progressed, I can sell directly to you across state lines if you go to my website and buy wine, which is great. And I get a higher margin, and there's, you know, all this business stuff that goes along with it. However, I can't do that for a restaurant. They can't come online and buy wine, and I can't mail it to them to be on their shelf because of these laws. So I do think that there's a net positive to distributorship. And I think you sign up with a distributor and you think, I have a sales team now. And I think that's like the common misconception where people really are sometimes let down. Like, you have a representative in the market, but they have thousands of other things they're selling. You know, they are, I try to just really think of them as like proponents for us, and they make great introductions, but you still have to go sell it. You still have to go get in the market and meet the people, because like I said, they're just, you know, a lot of times they've got so many other things to sell also. They're fulfilling things for you. They're fulfilling orders. They're also storing the wine in a temperature, hopefully temperature controlled place. And they're able to service that because a restaurant doesn't want to spend, could be millions of dollars. Not every business and restaurant can do that. And they say, you know, hey, I have this by the glass and I need 6 bottles a week. And they can trickle in 6 bottles a week. So they hold some of that inventory for you. And it's like, I'm one person in a 2-person winery, and we can't just mail stuff all the time because we have to grow the grapes and make the wine. So there's real benefits to the system. And I think really what you have to find is good people that you want to work with for the long term, because some of them are even franchise states. So you're kind of stuck with them forever. So really vetting the people that you're going to work with and work through, you're putting a lot of your, you know, you're putting your product in their hands. So if they're not good at delivering wine, you know, the restaurant wants the easiest thing. They're like, dude, I need this stuff to show up on Tuesday, and here's the check. And like, you know, if the distributor you're working with is not on it and paying attention, then your brand can suffer because, well, we don't do that anymore because the distributor didn't do a good job, you know? So you really put a lot onto your partners, or a lot in your partner's hands, and you make sure that you want to have a beer with them.
Make sure you want to hang out with these people.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
that have your livelihood.
I think the thing that we kind of say when we approach most folks is like, a bad deal with good people is just working through a problem. A good deal with bad people is always going to end poorly. And so trying to think of it in that way is like, are these folks that we want to be talking to and dealing with all the time? And I mean, I say dealing with, but you know, I think it's like, you spend so much energy trying to fix a lot of problems on the sales side that you end up, your wines suffer because it's taking the focus off of you. So there's a really big cohesive thing where like, you just want to make sure that you kind of have that sync and that it works well. Like, all I want to do is, you know, be in the vineyard and be in the cellar and like be messing around with the thing that we're making, you know, and chasing down people. We've had great relationships. We've had bad relationships, and you're just working through them all the time. It's part of business. I think we just need to not forget that everyone can make wine. You can make as much wine as you possibly want. And if no one's out there like helping get it to people and get it in the right hands. I mean, I think that's the other pro that I would say is like, most of the time these folks are able to put you in touch with people you'd never get to meet. You know, I can't just walk into like the finest dining establishment and be like, our wine is really good. You should sell it, please. You know, they're like, what are you doing, dude? Make an appointment. Get out of here. So they have those relationships, and those relationships are valuable. And what we try to think of is, how can we, through distributorship, I guess, like what's the main goal? Everyone would love to just have like an allocation list and you're making all of the money directly, but it's not that. I think you need both sides of the business to be healthy to really succeed. You know, you want to be in places where people that are really excited about wine have your bottle on their table and they go, man, that was really good. What is this? And like open the book a little bit, you know, you want to, and the right messaging and the right setting is really beneficial. And so
absolutely.
I don't want to discount that there's those things. And there's also so many different legal pieces that could really, I could really keep going for a very long time.
Oh my goodness. Especially like state to state, Jesus. But so let's say you've created the perfect relationship with the perfect distributor. These are people that you want to drink lots of beers with. They're getting your wines into the right places. Lots of great pros. What are some of the cons?
Some of the cons, and I say this
cons, like,
as a person still seeking distributorship in many states, tread lightly here.
Hypothetical,
you know, I think that hypothetical cons. I mean, it's a legal middleman, so there are people out there that take advantage of that system, and I think that's probably the biggest con is figuring out who you want to work with, because there's some people that just want to sign you up and have you on there, and like, you're buried in a book of a million other things. And, you know,
they're not like, advocating for you.
I'll give a great example. The good distributors get you in front of people that they know will be excited about your wines and they're in a price point that works and makes sense. And you walk in, you're like, this is an awesome place. I would love to be here. And I've gone out with reps who didn't do any homework at all. And you walk in and you look at their wine list and you're like, these guys are never going to buy anything. Like, this is a waste of your time, my time. Like, I flew here. You know, there's so that can be frustrating. So like, you're kind of at the whim of whoever you end up riding around with. So, like, watching how someone runs their business as a distributor is really important, because it trickles all the way down to, like, the disgruntled rep that you might ride around with that maybe is only going to last, like, 6 months and disappear, you know, go do something else. And so finding people who you can tell are passionate about it, and that aren't just retaining employees that aren't passionate about it also, that's the most important thing to me. I mean, you know, it really all boils down to people and how they're dealing with their accounts. You know, they are middlemen and it's legal, so you have to deal with them. And so they don't have to be good for you. You know, there's not a real, like, you like to think of it that the free market kind of dictates all these things. But when you have this intrusion kind of in this way, you end up with people who are like, well, we're signed up forever. And, like, if you want to leave, we have a franchise agreement, and I have the rights to sell you in this state forever. And they can really go down a bad path. And so,
yeah,
there are lots of nightmare stories out there. But I think it's really just making sure as a producer that you're going to be working with people that want to, and that you trust, and that relationship's going to be good, and that you can have an open conversation about things that are difficult, things that are hard, and make it work, because that's what it is. You're tying yourself to them for quite some time, and you need to be able to have a difficult conversation if you need to have a difficult conversation. Like I said, our goal is to try and get in people's hands that are going to be turned on to our brand. We don't make a ton of wine, so I value the fact that folks can do that, and I get to go and do market visits and meet people that I never would have met. Because I smashed grapes a couple of years ago, I get to meet somebody in, like, Menasha, Wisconsin. That's, like, the coolest thing to me. I mean, it's crazy. I would never go there
if
I hadn't made wine. I mean, like,
always one of my favorite parts of buying, and I'm sure you probably felt that way too up in Montana. It was just, like, when the winemaker came to town and came in with your reps, and you could meet this person that they had, talked so passionately about, and you've tasted the wines, but it brings a whole other level to the game when you have the person who touched those grapes and bottled that wine there talking about, their baby with you and drinking it, or getting to, do a dinner or a lunch with them or something. So how often — you're on the road a lot, I imagine — how often are you doing market visits?
I try to go to every market that we're in at least once a year, and sometimes twice. So quite a bit of traveling in the last year, more than I've ever done before. And then on top of, like, you just try to pepper them in between, like, farming responsibilities.
Yeah, how do you balance all of that side of it when you have to be making the wine every year?
I don't know the answer to that.
Sleep?
I've never done this much stuff. I was like, when I left my full-time job as a winemaker to go do to my side hustle job as a winemaker, I was like, I need to relax a little bit more and not, like, production schedule this and bottling dates and blah, 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 blah. I was like, I just need to relax a little bit more. And I'm like, doing more than I've ever done. But it feels better, because it's something that we own and we get to see. I mean, I think, that's another thing I would say is I never got to see people enjoy the wines that we made, really, when I was working for a big company and we're cranking it out. And I think, there's a huge value to, like, wines that people find on the shelf and are inexpensive and wine for the people that are good. And, like, if it turns you on to wine, at some point you're going to be like, we're all going to end up in Burgundy at some point, like, you end up, everybody's like, oh, I had this wine from wherever, from Trader Joe's even. And then, like, you start moving, you're like, oh, I'm captivated. And now I'm on the journey. So, like,
it's a gateway drug,
Anyway, I don't know how I balance all of it out, to be honest with you. You just like keep your head down and keep going. And, like, we know where we want to go and that we want to have our own place and be able to do our own things, but we're a small business. We bootstrapped this together. So I don't know how we do it all. I'm very tired most of the time, I think is the answer.
So what are some of the things that you have to do, other than, of course, working with the right distributors and the right people? What are some of the things that you have to do to kind of set yourself apart in this market?
Yeah, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, does the world need another winery? I don't know the answer to that.
I say yes.
But at the same time, I mean, look at it like anything else, does the world need another artist? Yeah, I think they do, because we would end up with no new art. And I think that's the thing, is that you've got to be at least a little bit crazy enough to be like, I'm going to go do this anyway, you know, in a sea of stuff that could be replaced on a shelf immediately. You know, if our wines disappeared from a market, something else is going on that shelf right away. And I think, you know, coming from the restaurant side of the world, you know, knowing how awesome it is to put a stellar bottle of wine on the table, you know, it's like an exclamation point on an experience. And it's just like,
especially with a good story,
now it's perfect.
Too,
you know what I mean? And like, it's a great and wine. I think that's the thing. It's like, it's, you want to do something that contributes to people's lives and enriches them. And I think that's like, that's kind of how we chase it. So I guess first it needs to be like, you just need to make something that is going to be really good. And there's, and I think wine can be very intimidating. It can be, how many adjectives can you say about this wine? Sometimes becomes the thing. It's like, how much can we talk about it? And you could do that forever. But at the very base level, like, I've gone to like, I've switched out of that. I'm like, binary code only. It's like 0 or 1. Like, do you like it or not like it? Like, that's, that needs to be first. We could talk about all of these things, but like, do you like the wine should be the first question. And I think any winemaker would say, if you do, awesome, please buy some. If you don't, there are, and this might not be an exact number that's correct, but there's like 60,000 wineries in the world. Like, there's something out there for you, you know, and like,
yeah,
you should move on from it. And we don't make enough wine to be like, I need everyone to like this. You know, I mean, I was joking the other day with a friend and was like, you know, honestly, if you don't like the wine that I make, then like, I didn't make it for you. And I know that's a very like kind of jerky thing to say. But, you know, like, it's just, we're all on a journey here, especially when you go down the rabbit hole of wine, that like, I want to taste everything and I want to get there in that way. And we just want to make something that's really, really great and invite people to come along with us, because we did start this without a lot of money. Or, you know, we would like to be at the place where we have our own, you know, our own winery, our own space. We're not cooking in other people's kitchens, and we're really able to do something for the long term because we want to do this forever. So, you know, we're kind of inviting people along that journey with us. You know, I'm not the best like sales guy. So the angle of like, how do we separate ourselves? I think we try to make really, really great wine that is very representative of the different sites that we work with. You know, for instance, we don't use any new oak on anything. We are just, I mean, my focus really is that the fruit is the most important thing. And like, I'm the least important thing. Of course, I'm going to like help try to shepherd these things through. But in all honesty, the sites that we work with are amazing. And I just want to champion, you know, what's coming out of them in individual ways. And I think when I see people in the market, even someone that's a novice taste through, you know, our 3 Pinot Noirs, for instance, it's like, they're so distinctly different, and it's because of where they come from and how they're farmed. You know, I think watching someone who maybe is a novice really like it click for them is one of my favorite things. That's reason enough to go into the market all the time. So it's really fun. 'Cause I remember when I was that way, I was like, oh
yeah,
I see. This is different, you know? Yeah, totally. It's like it's the most fun thing. So did I answer that question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, totally.
Where do we start? Where do we start there? How do I set myself apart? I don't know.
I just love listening to you talk about this because you're just so passionate.
I'm a good hang. That's the main thing.
He's just a good hang.
That's it. That's what I do. Yeah. No, it's I think you're right, though. It is difficult to set yourself apart in a sea of wine. And so I think that's the, like, keep the quality level high and be excited about it. I mean, I think everyone would like to jockey to be on the list of places that are really fancy and famous and you've heard of and blah, 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 blah. And like, that's great. But if you're buried on that list and it doesn't matter, I'd rather be on the short wine list at somewhere and the person's excited about it than to be buried somewhere. I mean, let me rephrase that. I would love to be on very nice restaurant lists.
You'd like to be on every list, top of
but
all the
yeah,
lists.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. But, you know, like that's you chase it, you know, if you chase that scale, your business, it's what are you chasing? And we want to make something that's really, really good and invite people along to come with us. You know, when we first started, it was really fun because, I mean, it still is really fun. Don't get me wrong. But when we first started, you know, there was a time period where we had met every single person that had had our wine. That was the craziest thing to me.
Cool.
And I knew that it wasn't going to stay that way forever, but like it is still a reason. That human connection is still a reason that we try to go into the market and be in new places. And there's nothing cooler than getting an email from someone that had your wine in a restaurant and wants to come meet you or come here and see Oregon.
Oh, cool.
And like make a suggestion of like six of my friends, some of whom that you've interviewed, to like go see them too. You know, like it isn't just like, I want you to drink my wine forever and that's it. You know, you want
sure.
to be able to mark time in special occasions with a great bottle of wine. And if it can be ours sometimes, I think that's awesome.
Cause talking about cost again a little bit, sorry to go from this beautiful romantic thing you just said back to numbers.
No, it has to be grounded. It has to make sense monetarily.
Right? So like it does. Like that's the thing. So you talk about all the work, you know, being done in the vineyard, the grapes, the site, that's the important thing. No new oak, which is hugely cost effective because for anybody who doesn't know, a new oak barrel is wicked expensive. Well, like how much? It can get up to like $1,500 more.
Yeah. They're pricey, you know?
They're very pricey.
Think and about also, it. You know, that's a someone cuts down a tree in France and has to send it all the way over here. That can't be cheap.
It's quite pricey. So what are some of the things that you have to do to operate a little more lean while still not sacrificing the quality of your product, of your wines? What are some of the tricks?
Do everything yourself. people are the most expensive part, I think. Keeping costs down is always difficult because you've got glass, you've got corks, you've got labels, you've got all of these dry goods that kind of go into this business together. On top of the cost of grapes, what you end up with in the bottle versus what you're paying for to do, you know, what else you're paying for, other maybe services like bottling itself. You know, the first couple of years we hand bottled everything. Now we use the bottling truck because we have a little bit more volume and I can't do it all by myself. So, you know, there's how do you keep everything in line? That's still something that we continually try to figure out because the business side of wine doesn't line up with the fiscal year of, let's say, the IRS. The revenue that you make as a business and how your business works is the current tax system is not set up for wineries at all. So there's like kind of a rabbit hole to go down in that as well. But you've got grapes that you purchase and you can't count that as an expense until you've sold the good. So like, if you're a growing winery, you know, I have a 500 case winery funding a 1,000 case winery. That was us 2 years ago. So you don't actually have that much money. And then your accountant's like, oh, and you owe this much in taxes. Cause on paper you've made money, but in real life you have it. In real life you have no money. And so
I didn't know that. That sucks.
Yeah. And we did it wrong the first like 2 years. So when we finally were like, we should have an accountant look at this, you know, she's great. And she was like, you did it wrong. And I said, I didn't do it. My partner did it. That was him. These are the learning experiences that you don't know about when you say, I want to start a winery or I want to do this thing. I don't have an MBA. I say that all the time. I don't have an MBA. So I don't know how to do most of the stuff. I know how to make wine and I can talk to people. But the business pieces are really, really difficult and you learn along the way. And to be honest, I'm lucky to be in Oregon because there's a lot of people that I've asked for advice and people in the Oregon wine industry are generally more than willing to share their experiences with you, things that they were able to do to mitigate some of that. And, you know, you just, because you're losing margin to a distributor, you know, it's very easy to need money. It's very easy to get down on yourself and be like, I'm going to run out of money if I don't do this, if I don't sell to these guys, if I don't sell this to these people that I don't have a good sense about maybe at first, but you do it because you need the money and it turns out to not be a great deal. That can happen for sure. But I think you have to try really, really hard to value what you're doing and not do that because then you end up in places where maybe a less excited drinker will be. You know, you want to be in the hands of people who are excited about you and not just on whatever shelf somewhere that's just gathering dust. And then, I mean, somebody walks through and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I found this in this cool shop. So like, maybe I shouldn't discount that. But, you know, when you're looking at, people always want to haggle on price. And I think you have to say, this is what we do. And this is what we need to survive as a business and feel good about that on your quality level. And if it's overpriced for someone, maybe it isn't for another person. And like, you have to kind of stand up for yourself in that way, even though you're like, man, I could use this money right now. Like you just don't want to fire sale things.
And that's hard sometimes to stand up for yourself as far as
you have to make good decisions for your business too. Cause it's like, well, the general thing that we say all the time is like, we look for really good opportunities and then we try to make really good decisions. There's some opportunities that come along that are great, that are horrible decisions. And if it checks both those boxes, we kind of will go for it. But That's just something that we kind of keep in our brains is like, is this going to be a good decision in the long run? I mean, we want to do this. We want De La Boo to be around forever. Like this is what I want to do with my life. So How can we continue to do it, but be smart about it and not have maybe done things to over leverage ourselves, put ourselves in a position to where we need that money? You know, like our next step will be a really big one. And so, you know, if it's a small business loan, it's like, oh, now I need the money because the bank's going to come after me, which we have taken no outside money yet. We want to keep the business going and we want to make decisions that allow us to stay in control of it and protect our own investment that we've already made and not have to chase things, have to chase scale, have to chase volume just to like pay back the note, you know? And I think that's
a potential
like
risk
the big part of like us bootstrapping a winery is that we've come a long way. Like our next step, every time we're like, oh man, we're like almost there. It's almost making sense. When we look forward, we're like, that's a really big step. But then we often forget to look back and say the step that we've taken, like from zero to here is actually the furthest.
It's already,
you know, like the next one is really not that big when you think of going from 150 cases to 2,500 cases.
Well, talking next steps, as you mentioned, what are your hopes and dreams moving forward for De La Boo and your plans? What's the next move?
That is a great question. there's the wine piece of like what we want to do. And I think we're kind of already executing the type of wines that we want to make, the food friendly kind of type of wines that we want to make, a little bit lower in alcohol than some others. You know, really just trying to nail it on the wine and the sites that we work with. That I feel like is like fairly locked in. And I think we make more wine if we have good opportunities to work with vineyard partners that we want to work with, and keep that out front. But as a business, I think, you know, maybe probably the most important part is just how we're going to grow and what we're going to do. I'd rather build around people than scale or volume. And I think having the right people involved with us is the most important thing. And so, you know, you scale up too far and you're like, oh my God, I need a person to help me sell this. And then you maybe get someone, because you have to have someone that's disinterested in, you know, what can you afford to pay them? And I think we'd rather grow this business together with our, you know, employees or partners. I mean, we have long wanted to provide equity to anybody that's coming in with us and say, you can have a piece of this. The sky's the limit. We can do whatever we want. If it's about just making a ton of money, there's probably other places to be. But it seems like that equity model is not provided for a lot of hospitality, a lot of wineries. I mean, that's why you see winemakers bounce around to a bunch of different places before they finally start their own thing. So they can kind of have control of it. And I think that like finding the right people and saying, hey, you're a person that we feel like we could really invest in and bring into this group of just the other two of us and say, how can we give you a piece of the business and come along with us to go? We started an initiative called Blue Collar Equity, where we are trying to create a legal framework for people that want to do something like that, provide equity to their employees in a broader sense that's more restaurant, hospitality-based, winery, just based around hospitality. I mean, you see it like in big companies all the time, people get equity and you know, coming from restaurants and, you know, knowing your background as well is probably resonate with you. It's like, if you're a really good server, how do nobody ever wants to be a good server for life, it seems, you know? I mean, there are certainly people that do it and are very, very good at it. But like, if there's no financial upside other than getting tips, like, you know, I know that you want to get out at 10 o'clock or whatever time you got cut. Like, you know,
it's a very niche.
But if someone would like to do that, I think helping to provide that framework of and a set of documents, it's like, here are different ways that you can go about it on the business side, because that's something that you usually don't understand. I know I didn't when we started this, and it's, I think, important, you know, and usually people that are doing these types of things want to be doing that thing and they don't want to be dealing with all of this business kind of extra stuff. You know, I want to make wine. I don't want to do any of the paperwork. I don't want to look at a spreadsheet. I can do back of the napkin math and say, maybe it's a good idea. Maybe it's not.
Sounds great.
But I think there's like providing some resources for people to see those things is really important to me. So we're trying to get that off the ground and have a website around it where you can go open source legal documents to do things like this. So I think it'll be really,
that's fantastic.
I think it'll be really great.
Yeah, that's amazing. Cause I've learned so much from you talking about this, about some of the nuance. And I know there's a boatload more that we haven't talked about. So many episodes. Well, where can we find your wines? Where are you distributed at the moment? And then are we able to go online and purchase your wine? You mentioned going on your website.
Yeah, so we, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I have the wonderful dilemma of being sold out of all our previous vintages of wine, which is awesome. Now that doesn't mean that they're not available in certain markets. I just don't know everywhere that they are. So you might be able to find things there in the world. But we are, so states that we're sold in, that you could find us at your local wine shop or in some of your some restaurants around, is the states that we're in are Maine, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Montana, Ohio, Wisconsin, Oregon, of course, we self-distribute here, Georgia, and Utah.
Oh, you made it into Utah. Wow.
We made it into Utah. And actually, Utah is the best. I love Utah. I never thought I would say that, but like the state is a distributor and they pay on time. It's just like,
I like that.
It's awesome. I mean, everything about it is really good. And it's a great market as well.
And we can find you on social media as well.
Yeah. And then you can find us on social media. Delaboue, if you type D-E-L-A-B-O-U-E, you'll find it. And then our website, delaboue.com. You can sign up for the allocation list if you'd like. It helps us gauge how much wine we should make in the future and get to connect with people on a real personal level. Twice a year we ship out, and then, you know, hopefully you get turned on to us by one of our distribution partners. And come visit.
Fabulous. Yes, go visit. So if you're in any of those states that Travis just listed, look for Delaboue on your retail shelves and go check them out on social media, online. And if you are in Oregon, go visit Travis and drink his beautiful wines. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat about all of this amazing, nuanced, complicated stuff that we really don't think about. You know, the wine has quite a journey to make from the vineyard into our glass. And thank you for shining some light onto that portion of it.
Yeah, my pleasure. If I can help someone that's starting out, peel the onion back and see a few more things, I think it's a noble cause, that's for sure.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to today's episode. I want to thank especially Travis Todd of Delaboue Wines. Everyone should try these wines. They're really, really tasty. And I want to thank Claire Copey for hosting this episode. I want to thank John Adams, our producer. Don't forget to go to SomTV.com for hundreds of hours of the best educational and entertainment content you can get, including our new episode, Behind the Glass, on William Selyem, and our closer look at Prosecco. And if you're waiting for Cup of Salvation, don't worry. News is coming very soon on that. All right, everybody, please be safe and have a great 2024.